Coming up on this week's book show, Richard Powers spent a year under the redwoods of California. That reflection led to his novel, The Overstory, about a world of trees and a band of people determined to change the way it's perceived. The Overstory won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. We will re-air our interview with Powers on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. National Book Award-winning author Richard Powers spent a year under the redwoods of California. It was through that reflection that he realized he had never really addressed the fundamental conflict on this planet, the one taking place between humans and the rest of creation. The winner of the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, The Overstory, is a novel about the world of trees and a band of people determined to change the way it's perceived. In the book, we meet nine central characters over a half century of American life. It's the story of a handful of people who learn how to see that world and who are drawn up into its unfolding catastrophe. In addition to his recent Pulitzer win, Richard Powers was the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant in 1989 and won the National Book Award for The Echo Maker in 2006. The Overstory was shortlisted for the 2018 Man Booker Prize. It was a New York Times bestseller, a New York Times notable book, and a Washington Post, Time Magazine, Oprah Magazine, Newsweek, Chicago Tribune, Kirkus Review, and Amazon Best Book of the Year. The Kirkus-starred review called the book, quote, a masterpiece of operatic proportions, a magnificent achievement. We spoke with Richard Powers when The Overstory was first published. The book has since been published in paperback. We present an encore airing of our interview now. I love this novel, and it's just so beautiful. Give us a sense of what brought you to the redwoods of California. Was it conscious that this is something that you wanted to write about going in, or was it a result of that experience?
It very much was not in my mind when I arrived in California. I took a job at Stanford teaching in the creative writing program there. Stanford's in Palo Alto in the Central Peninsula, right in the heart of Silicon Valley. In fact, it's Stanford itself, I think, that kind of generated Silicon Valley to begin with. But you're in a town surrounded by the corporate headquarters of the companies that have created the present and are creating the future. So Google, Apple, Intel, HP, Facebook, you name it. It creates a very intense, very go-go culture. Fortunately, just to the other side of town are the Santa Cruz Mountains, and through many enlightened people, the forests, the redwood forests that had grown all along the length of that mountain chain have been allowed to come back, and that land has been set aside as open space, public wilderness. And I would head up into the mountains to get away from Silicon Valley and the press of the future and, in a sense, return to the past, those forests that had been cut down to build San Francisco a couple of times, actually. And I guess you could say are indirectly responsible for the presence of Silicon Valley itself. Those forests had been allowed to grow back, and it's a great restoration for me to go up there for a day and just walk under these magnificent trees. I wasn't particularly a tree person going into my stay in California, but I don't know if you've ever walked under redwoods, you know it doesn't yeah. take great sensitivity to feel that sanctity. And I guess it was one day, not too long into that year, as I was hiking the trails in those set aside beautiful second growth forests, that I came across an uncut redwood. And I had been knocked out by what that tree could do in 100 years. When you let it go for 1,000, it just turns into another kind of creature altogether. And, you know, I stood in front of this tree. It was as wide as a house, as tall as a football field is long, and maybe as old as Jesus. And I just had this transcendental moment. I don't know what else to call it, where I realized what these forests must have looked like before we got to them. And I began to think about the use that we had put them to and the abuse that we had put them to. And, you know, here I was poised between a very, very ancient past and a very immediate accelerating future. And that's when this book began to form in my mind, and I began to think of this long love-hate marriage between people and trees, these other creatures that we share the world with and that we owe our existence to, both biologically and culturally. And I thought, you know, I haven't seen a lot of that treatment in literary fiction, and there might just be room for that kind of story.
In the course of your answer, you said, going into California, never considered yourself a tree person. What do you think of when you think of what a tree person is? Is it someone who respects?
Yeah, I mean, I probably had a number of impressions, not particularly well-formed, just as I had a number of impressions about what trees were, not particularly well-informed. And it was the act of losing that blindness and of educating myself, not just to the names of trees and the varieties of their behavior and their incredible diversity and beauty and ingenuity, but their indispensable impact on who we are and what we've been able to become, that so transfixed me for the 5 years that it took me to write this book. So my impression of who tree people are changed profoundly, and in fact, the book itself retraces some of that journey. I tell the story of 9 people, very, very different, with very different backgrounds, each of whom has to come to think about trees and their own personal dependence on trees and their own species dependence on trees in a very different way. So, you know, there are characters in the book who made a similar journey to my own, where that label tree hugger initially might have been a little bit disparaging or a little bit condescending. And, you know, at the end of the tremendous long journey, realize, you know, that our blindness to these magnificent things that we share the planet to needs to change, and we need to learn how to take them as seriously as we take ourselves.
This is a story, as you say, of 9 people, but these people are all, the one thing they have in common is that they have all learned to see this beautiful world of trees and how interconnected and magnificent and inventive this world is.
Yes, and some of them do that through very personal means. Some of them take up arms in the struggle for the last remaining 2 or 3% of old growth forest that this continent still enjoys. Some of them come to trees through a more empirical or scientific bent, and that allowed me to talk about the astonishing discoveries about trees that have just proliferated over the last 3 decades and have hugely increased our understanding of what they do. You know, that trees talk to each other over the air. They share a kind of mass immune system. They're connected underground to each other. They feed each other. They nurse each other. They share resources. And because these 9 people are learning about trees in all different kinds of ways, the aggregate, the forest, if you will, what happens when each of these individuals come together into a single storyline, allows me to take the tree and to enhance what we're able to see in it from many, many different directions.
Richard Powers is our guest in this week's book show. The name of the novel is The Overstory. The book is published by Norton. Do the trees need these people? Do they need us to be their defenders?
Well, technically, no. I think part of the story is the realization, the belated realization on the part of some of these defenders of trees, just how long trees have been around and just what they've been able to survive. And the slow realization that it may, in fact, be us that needs defending. Mm. Trees go back 200 or 300 million years, and they've been through mass extinctions before. They are going through one now, as is the rest of the planet. And it's one that's brought about directly by human activity. If I were to put money on whether which would be more likely to survive, human culture in its current form or large woody plants up on a stem branching out and turning sunlight directly into food, I think the latter is a stronger bet. But really what the book is about is what it would take for us to live in this world with them, what it would take for us to understand the neighbors, to understand how deeply dependent on the neighbors we've been. In other words, it's really a book about the survival of humanity and the transformation of humanity and how that might come about. Trees will go on. I do not believe that we will go on in our current form. I don't see how we can.
But you do, in at least in my reading of the novel, I came away with this feeling that if there were more people like those that you write about in the story, that we wouldn't be in the predicament that we're in now.
I think that's true. And the arrival point of the book is in some ways that this great project that lies ahead of us, moving back into the world, remembering that we're not separate, we're not alone, we're not some kind of exclusive thing, that we are continuous with the rest of creation. That great project is going to require, as a certain minimal step one, a tree unblinding, a plant unblinding, people making the journey that the people in this book make, and simply developing the ability to see, to look, to understand that there are these other incredibly long-lived, incredibly massive, slow-moving but supple, ingenious creatures that are doing all kinds of things that we've simply not paid attention to. If we can make that first step, if we can become tree conscious, then perhaps we can see our way forward into the larger challenge of the meaningful pursuit of coming back home.
The name of the novel is The Overstory. You tell this in really a series of interlocking fables. Talk a little bit about how you came upon the way that you tell the story about these nine individuals.
Well, once I had this moment of momentary unblinding myself and this heightened awareness of the redwoods, I came back east and began to see the trees of my own youth and childhood and young adulthood and adulthood in an entirely new way. And I just fell in love with the infinite variety and the diversity of tree behaviors. And I began to read everything that I could possibly put my hands on. And that is, simple field guides, the scientific research that I mentioned earlier, poetry and prose, love songs to trees, and I began to realize that so much of world literature, so much of the earliest stories that we ever told ourselves are love songs to these creations. And the human fascination with trees, you know, it was astonishing to me over this time period when I told people that I was writing about trees. Everyone had a story. Everyone had a personal, sometimes near religious, relationship, either with an individual outstanding tree or with forests, places they could go to be on another time frame, to be on another sense of physical scale. And it was the aggregation of those stories from all over, the myths and legends of indigenous people all around the world, the stories of the great naturalists of the 18th and 19th century, the personal stories of my contemporaries, my friends, family, and loved ones, that went into the making of this book. And it did get perhaps a little bit long, but it was that joy of traveling around the theme and finding the ways that the desires of nature, the suppleness and ingenuity of natural selection, and the social quality of trees, the memory of trees, the way they come together in this superorganism, the forest, that just so moved me that I had to find a way of getting that into a novel and weaving it through the story, the more traditional novelistic stories about people and their backstories and the crises that they have with themselves and others.
I don't know this. It's my assumption, though, that many of those stories that you heard have to do with a relationship that began in childhood.
You know, and it was interesting in these nine characters. I did bring a bit of biography to some of them, and these stories of, you know, it's interesting to think about how often a tree is planted to mark a human occasion, a birth, a death, a marriage, a christening. And one of the characters who's initially resistant to the idea of that he thinks is fairly far out about granting trees legal standing or of putting your body in harm's way in order to prevent the destruction of a forest, is converted in part by his own childhood memory of a tree that was an individual tree that was deeply dear to him because it was planted to mark his birth. That was a recreation of a personal memory, and it wasn't until I was deep into the book that I remembered that there's a maple tree on the north shore of Chicago that was put in the ground the day I was born and is in some strange way now has come back to resume its place as my alter ego.
Richard Powers is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the novel is The Overstory. Let's talk about some of the characters that you write about in the book. There are, as I mentioned, there are these nine central characters, and I'd like to mention a few of them. You talked earlier in our discussion about this idea of the intelligence of trees and the communication that they have with one another. Dr. Patricia Westerford is a field biologist that you write about, and she's ultimately mocked by her profession for making that argument that trees are intelligent, that they have these communication skills.
Right. When she's in graduate school, she comes up with the idea of studying the possibility that trees might be chemically signaling each other, and through very rigorous, long research, she's able to determine that, in fact, when a tree is infected with an insect assault, for instance, that it puts out chemical messages over the air, and that nearby trees receive these chemical messages and begin a kind of spontaneous self-immunization, making them resistant to the same infestation. And she puts that forward in a very careful and scientific way, but because of the time in which she's doing the research and because of the fact that she's a woman, the field, which as many scientific fields is very conservative, decides to launch both barrels at her, and she's so distraught by this resistance and the professional public humiliation that she undergoes that she goes underground for many years. And it's only by accident, years later, when she's working for the Forest Service, that she learns, in fact, not only have people begun to replicate her research, but that she herself has been resurrected and is now considered a kind of pioneer. And that story itself comes from several stories in the historical archive of dendrological research in recent years. There have been several people who have made similar or even stranger, more challenging claims that have had to fight their way through the conservative nature of their discipline and vindicate their claims. In addition to over-the-air signaling, which Patricia was so interested in as a young woman, she gets interested in, as an older woman, in this amazing set of discoveries having to do with the underground networking together of trees, where fungal filaments connect trees over the course of miles, and not just trees of the same species, but trees of different species. And this reciprocal mutualist relationship whereby the tree is supplying the fungus with the sugars that the fungus can't photosynthesize directly for itself, and the fungus is breaking down rocks, feeding the tree minerals, catching invertebrates, catching springtails, and digesting them and feeding them to the trees. And the fungus is acting as these great intermediary bankers across an entire forest, keeping shaded trees alive for long periods of time, keeping wounded trees alive, you know, distributing the resources of the forest in a strange cooperative way. That magnificent discovery of how far from this kind of crude Darwinianism that we often think about when we think about nature, you know, survival of the fittest and red in tooth and claw and all those cliches that emphasize competition, Patricia's work is in the vanguard of what's happening now, which is the realization that cooperation has to be at least as important as competition, perhaps more important.
Richard Powers is our guest. The name of the new novel is The Overstory. We're just about out of time, but you've used this word a few times, and I want to end with it, which is unblinding. How do we open ourselves to that unblinding?
The novel traces a long journey, and each of these characters goes through catastrophes that unmake and remake them. At the end of the book, the artist, Nick Houle, who's the first of the nine characters that you're introduced to, is making this tremendous land art project where he's laying out logs on the forest floor to spell out a word in the knowledge that over the course of decades and even centuries, these logs will be the nurse logs for another generation of trees, and that in the run of time, in the run of centuries, there will be a new generation of trees that follows the lines of these logs and actually spells out an enormous word. The word is still. And that word has many, many meanings. For me, I think the essential one is if you are to see what's in front of you, not what you'd like to be in front of you, not what you think is in front of you, but what is actually in front of you, you just have to hold still.
Richard Powers' new novel is The Overstory. It is published by Norton. Richard, it's a beautiful novel. I thank you so much for sharing with us and wish you all the luck in the world.
Thank you so much, Joe. It was great talking to you.
Richard Powers' novel, The Overstory, won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. It is published by Norton. We'll leave you with an excerpt from the audiobook.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present The Overstory by Richard Powers. Narrated by Suzanne Torin. Roots. First, there was nothing. Then, there was everything. Then, in a park above a western city after dusk, the air is raining messages. A woman sits on the ground, leaning against a pine. Its bark presses hard against her back, as hard as life. Its needles scent the air, and a force hums in the heart of the wood. Her ears tune down to the lowest frequencies. The tree is saying things, in words before words. It says, "Sun and water are questions endlessly worth answering." It says, "A good answer must be reinvented many times, from scratch." It says, "Every piece of earth needs a new way to grip it. There are more ways to branch than any cedar pencil will ever find. A thing can travel everywhere just by holding still." The woman does exactly that. Signals rain down around her like seeds. Talk runs far afield tonight. The bends in the alders speak of long-ago disasters. Spikes of pale chinkapin flowers shake down their pollen. Soon they will turn into spiny fruits. Poplars repeat the wind's gossip. Persimmons and walnuts set out their bribes, and rowans their blood-red clusters. Ancient oaks wave prophecies of future weather. The several hundred kinds of hawthorn laugh at the single name they're forced to share. Laurels insist that even death is nothing to lose sleep over. Something in the air's scent commands the woman. Close your eyes and think of willow. The weeping you see will be wrong. Picture an acacia thorn. Nothing in your thought will be sharp enough. What hovers right above you? What floats over your head right now? Now! Trees even farther away join in. All the ways you imagine us, bewitched mangroves up on stilts, a nutmeg's inverted spade, gnarled Baja elephant trunks, the straight-up missile of a sal, are always amputations. Your kind never sees us whole. You miss the half of it and more. There's always as much below ground as above. That's the trouble with people, their root problem. Life runs alongside them, unseen, right here, right next, creating the soil, cycling water, trading in nutrients, making weather, building atmosphere, feeding and curing and sheltering more kinds of creatures than people know how to count. A chorus of living wood sings to the woman. If your mind were only a slightly greener thing, we'd drown you in meaning. The pine she leans against says, "Listen, there's something you need to hear."
Susanna Torin narrating the audiobook of Richard Powers's The Overstory. The book is published by Norton. The audiobook is produced and distributed by Recorded Books and RB Digital. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.